Mike here. House Bill 3050 comes to us from the Oregon Municipal Finance Officers Association. And it revamps a whole slew of ORSs that have to deal with the local budget law. And the local budget law, as you're probably very familiar with, is prescribed in great detail in the statutes. Few changes here that take out some of the details, especially about salary ranges, puts them in somewhere else in a much more precise way of full-time equivalent. It defines the overseeing procedures of the commission that is established, the Commission of Supervision and Conservation, and it makes that commission the recipient of some of the publications and the documentations of the budget law. In that sense, Mr. Chair, the bill itself does not have a revenue impact. However, the fiscal impact of this bill is not clear yet. I was speaking to the fiscal office yesterday, and they have not received all the information from the different municipal governments, especially schools, I think what they were saying, as whether to know how the impact and the requirements of this bill will be on their reporting and how they comply with it. So that was not clear until last night.
Are we going to get a report? When you say fiscal impact, do you mean to the state then or to...
I think in their way of thinking was is not... It's mainly to the school boards, school districts, and at the same time, how if that would filter anywhere to the state.
Okay. Well, I tell you, let's get some testimony on this morning. Then I have Linda Borgelhaus. Is that it? Did I come close? Close. Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, I want to thank you for this opportunity. For the record, my name is Linda Borgelhaus. I am with the Director of the Tax Supervising Conservation Commission out of Multnomah County. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Municipal Finance Officers Association. I am a board member of that organization, and this is a bill that is being sponsored by them. OMFOAA is a statewide organization of individuals that work in the financial area of local governments. And before each legislative session, this group meets and reviews local budget law, determines if there's anything that we would like to bring forth as suggested changes to you. The last OMFOA bills that we brought forth were in 97, when we did a major change to local budget law. 99, we came in and made some corrections, and now we're back this year with House Bill 3050. This process in coming to this bill involved OMFOA finance officers from cities, counties, and tax supervising, the Oregon Department of Revenue, the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, Special Districts Association. And as a group, we identified areas that we felt that needed to have changes and could improve the local budget law system within the state of Oregon. I've prepared a handout for you that I'd like to just briefly go over and tell you what changes we're recommending. For the most part, most of these are housekeeping, things that we hope would make the process go smoother or actually hopefully get some more public interest into the budget process as we're working through it. There is one policy change that I do want to bring to you also. The first three sections of this bill deal with what we identified as a problem within the current law. Budgets are required to contain a master salary schedule. And this salary schedule is at a very high level. It groups everybody together, does not give a lot of informative information. And what we found was it's buried in a budget. No one even sees it. And so we'd like to take that portion requirement out of the law for that specific form, knowing that salary information and employee information detail is still available at the district, and replace that with a requirement that each year the district would have to, in their annual publication of their budget, include in the newspaper the total full-time equivalents for the year that or budget that they're in and the similar number for the upcoming budget. And hopefully this would be a little more user-friendly to the public. The second thing in Section 4 is a publication. We would like to try to make this publication in the newspaper a little friendlier to the public and a little easier for them to look at and understand. And so we're proposing that the format on the fund details be changed to where it would be a summary page that would show each fund, again, the current budget, the upcoming budget, so it can make an easy comparison in the, and citizens could look at that and see the total overall summary of the whole budget broken down by personal services, materials and services, or in the case of school districts for instruction services, support services, those types of breakdown would still remain there. So they would see both formats. Section 5 deals with an audit violation problem that arises. This is a policy change. Under current law, when a budget is prepared, when the auditors come in at the end of the year, they compare what has actually happened to the budget that was prepared. Did the district stay within the limitations that they set upon themselves? We have a couple instances where districts are receiving violations in these audits that we think that are not always a result of poor budgeting practices. And then those two instances are, one, when money is being reimbursed from a governmental agency. A county may be required to provide services to its citizens, and the federal government will totally reimburse them for those expenses. If during the budget more people come for those services, the county will receive their money as planned from the government, but if they are on an accrual basis, at the moment the service is provided, they have to declare that money spent. And so after the end of the year, they're finding that they are being written up for overexpending their budget, and really they were serving their citizens with the best interest. And we feel that this negative comment in the audit could be avoided if the boards were allowed to publicly pass a resolution or ordinance that amended that budget and took care of that. The second instance where we would like to have that ability for them to go back and change something that's already happened is in the area of capital expenditures. A couple of years ago, the Port of Portland at the PDX was doing their major change, as they always are at the airport, and we had an unusually dry June. All of a sudden, their capital projects just were moving ahead very rapidly. They were way ahead of schedule, but when the audit came out, they had a major, major over expenditure in the millions of dollars because they had spent more than they anticipated. When they prepared that budget, they did it in a very reasonable manner, and they should have been within budget, but because the sun was shining, they had a terrible, it made them look like they had really not stayed within budget.
Do they have a June 30 year end or something?
June 30th year end, but what happened was this happened in June, and the day it happened, it accrued as an expense. And so it just, and so for those very two tight specific areas, we do not want this expanded to, if they simply overexpend because of poor budgeting, to be able to get out of an audit violation there, but in these two instances, we'd like to see that changed. Going to the second page, the five-year loan, this districts are allowed to borrow money if they have it in another fund, and that fund is not restricted from themselves. This is a good policy. However, the statute is written so that it's somewhat unclear. It's caused a lot of confusion, and all we're doing here is trying to lay out very clearly how that should be budgeted and how it should show. The other instance within this is the governing body will set the rate of interest, and in that resolution that makes the loan, sets the interest, we'd like to make sure that they have the appropriation to pay it back. We found some that then had to turn around and do a supplemental just to pay the interest that they've already established, and do it in one step rather than two. Section 7 and 8 deal with my office. The first one in Section 7 is adding some jurisdiction language to clarify it, make it the same as it is for any time a district boundary extends beyond Multnomah County into one of the surrounding counties. This will not change any district that's under our jurisdiction. It won't add to, delete from. It's just simply for clarification. The second item there in Section 8 changes the filing date. The law currently have districts in Multnomah County file their budget with my office 15 days after they adopt and with the assessor's office on July 15th. And this creates more work and more hassle for them, and we'd like to change that to everything's just July 15th. Makes more sense. They have time then to get that budget ready. Section 9, again, is a Multnomah County tax supervising issue. The law requires a budget to be filed with each county clerk every year. In Multnomah County, we have the agreement that it comes to my office. We have a longer retention schedule. Taxpayers are accustomed to coming to that office for any budget or audits that they want. And we have this agreement between the offices that we're the repository, but yet if you read the law, it looks like it needs to go there, and it's creating confusion and also the expense of an extra budget being sent that really doesn't need to be. The last section, Section 10, was brought forth after our original group met. This was brought forth by the Department of Revenue. This is probably one of the most needed in this bill of anything. When language was drafted after Measure 50 on how levies were to be calculated, the reference to the unappropriated ending fund balance was left out of the debt service portion. And the unappropriated ending fund balance is the money that a district will need to pay anything that arises between July 1 and when the tax receipts come in November. So if they have interest or principal payments during that time, the way the law is currently written, they can't collect taxes for those, so they would be put in a position of even going out and to borrow to pay their debt. And no one is operating this way because, quite frankly, no one until just a few weeks ago even realized that this error was in here. So it started as a drafting error, but it really is something that needs to be taken care of. So I'd really encourage your support on this bill. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. Do we have any questions, especially from our former mayors, city councilors, or school board members?
Representative Bergman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't realize, I'm sorry, that your organization existed, this supervision. How are you structured with regard to Multnomah County? Could you explain that to me?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. We are established by the legislature, and we have been in existence since 1919. Mm-hmm. And we basically oversee the property taxes. All the districts within Multnomah County submit their budgets to their approved budgets to us. We then go through those. We certify them. And in the cases of the larger districts, the five commissioners that are appointed by the governor actually conduct the public hearing.
This is only Multnomah County.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, this is only Multnomah County. It's any county. Every county can have this organization. It's mandatory if there are over 500,000 in population, so it's mandatory within Multnomah County and optional in the others.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I don't live in Multnomah County and wasn't aware that there was...
We're unique.
One of those groups that works so well, we don't even know they're there. Anything else? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The only one else I have signed... wait, I'm sorry. I do have one question. You can have a seat. Mazin mentioned something in his overview about possible fiscal impact. Are you aware of any fiscal impacts to this from the work that you do?
Mr. Chair, I do not think so. I think in some cases this will actually relieve some of the burden on the districts. And since the people that actually prepare those budgets are the ones that have really put together this and their organizations, I think that they're looking out for their not creating more work and more problems for themselves.
Well, we may have Mazin work with you after today to make sure that we get a statement to that effect and clarify for the record there's no fiscal impact and we can move this thing.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Just for the record, the impact or the fiscal office have not received the reply back.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks very much. All right. Tom Gallagher, have you decided yet?
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher. I represent the Oregon Newspaper Publishers. I thought this was going to be fairly simple for me. I was looking at page 1, line 24 of the bill, where it says that they want to eliminate the language. It says they will list the salaries for the officers and employees, and then I understand the qualifying language when you have light classifications, et cetera. They were going to they want to replace it on page 2 with the section 3, subsection 5, by listing the full-time equivalent positions. And for us and for our purposes as a newspaper, I thought listing the salaries, especially the higher salaries of the people, was fairly important. And when I talked to the proponents, this got much more complicated than I thought it was going to be, which is why I put down undecided. I suggest that we spend some time talking to them about the budget process and the documents and about what documents we like to look at. My thought is we're going to not object and drop our position because we may want to come back in next session with a bill that takes a look at clarifying a lot more and easier how you get this information out in the published documents. It ought to be simpler and easier to read. It ought not be classification positions that they then have to go to the department and ask for specific salaries.
Right.
So I don't know if we can solve that in this bill. The bulk of the bill, I think, is great. I mean, it is administrative. It's this one publishing piece of what seems to be an important item.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, Tom. I understood from the testimony from Ms. Berglehaus that every year was to actually put, I guess, make the information more relevant, which sounds like it's moving in the direction you want to go.
Mr. Chair, I think it's moving in the direction of the things that are already being done. There's also another section in here where the Department of Education wants their information done differently, and they'll separate that out. And what I need to figure out is the information being prepared for the value of the budget folks, or is the information being prepared in a way that makes it opaque and easy for the public to understand when they see the document? So. Thank you.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Gallagher? All right. Well, you can work with talk with Ms. Berglehaus while we get the fiscal issue resolved and try and get that up, back up again maybe next week. We have a letter in the file from League of Oregon Cities. I understand we will not be having any testimony from the League, but just to remark on the record that that is there. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on House Bill 3050 today before I close the public hearing? All right, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3050. I'll ask for a little bit of work to be done on this and get this back up on the schedule when we're ready to go.
All right,
let's go back to where we left off last week, looking at some of these tax expenditure bills. I understand we have some amendments to look at and certainly some revenue impacts that we want to see to get better informed of today. We're getting double teamed. We got Paul up here, and Elizabeth is out there. Mm-hmm. All right. Let me open then. I guess we'll just take it from the top of the order. Okay. That's good. We'll do that. We'll open a hearing on all four of the next bills, House Bill 2505, 3183, 2506, and 2950. We're in public hearing on all of those, so... we can receive testimony on any or all the bills. And I think first we have our discussion about OTIM and how we get to some of the numbers we're going to be looking at. Is that it, Elizabeth?
Mr. Chairman.
Well, just Mr. Chair, we did give you OTIM results last week. We've just the results themselves aren't any different. We've just changed the presentation a little bit, but Elizabeth will walk through some of the basic outlines of OTIM for those not familiar with it, and I'll finish up by talking a little bit about some of the caveats.
All right.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. Since OTIM is our new model, it's called the Oregon Tax Incident Model, and that's what OTIM stands for, and it was developed during the 2000 interim. It was authorized by the 99 legislature to begin this incident model. But really, I just want to make sure everyone's kind of clear what this model does in relationship to the other models that we use. And it really is something of a unique nature. It is cutting edge as far as the computable general equilibrium models are concerned. And it really is, has been very effective at, to begin with, addressing two policy objectives. And first is just to provide lawmakers with information on the overall distribution of the tax burden of Oregon's taxes by households. Okay, now we've got like the personal income tax calculator, and that one will give you information by different income groups of the burden of income taxes. But that's it, and that's where that stops. Where this model now is going to incorporate all of Oregon's taxes. And so as we go through this, you'll see that we've, you know, encompassed every tax that is assessed in Oregon. And basically we're wanting to get at, you know, with households, they're owners of capital, and they're also suppliers of labor, and they're consumers of goods and services, and then they're recipients of government aid. So we've captured all those various functions in this model. And we're developing, and the second major objective is to develop then a capacity to identify and quantify some of these behavior responses to significant tax changes. And that's really where we are today. That's how we're using OTM and this kind of a capacity to look at various proposals that you have before you and look at what kind of economic behavior feedback effects are occurring. And these behavior adjustments are made by producers and consumers in response to tax changes that they're seeing in their economy. So what we do is have a computable general equilibrium model. That's what the model is. And just, you know, so you understand a little bit, computable is the word used because we use a computer to find actual numeric solutions to the model, okay, that is posed. What you're doing is you have an equilibrium, and that's, you know, the next word there in the model. So what we begin with a system in Oregon that is in equilibrium. So prices have adjusted in the model in order to create an equilibrium where the supply of goods and services and factors of production are all equal. So with equilibrium, then you see that what you're going to have then are prices that adjust when we go in and we shock the equilibrium system with these various tax changes that we're proposing. And this model is general because it includes all the markets, income flows are included in the model. And again, it is just Oregon's economy, but it's our economy in relationship to the rest of the world. So we do have a rest of the world sector, which includes other states as well as, you know, overseas consumers that we may have. Now, as far as the number, there are like 118 distinct sectors in OTM. You have 29 industrial sectors. You have 8 consumption, commodity, aggregates. And you have 2 factors of production, labor and capital, but capital does really include all your other factors of production. You have 8 household groups. You have 1 savings and investment sector. And you have 69 government revenue items. Now, this is really, you know, this is what is giving us all the flexibility to be able to use OTM, because you have 11 different government taxes, you got 33 state taxes, and you got 25 local taxes for a total of 69 different government taxes that we can shock then in the system and see what kind of feedback effects that you get. You also have 7 government spending categories. So in the government spending, they're split out by school education and non-education, local and state, and then investment and public investment for the government sector. And then, as I was saying, there's 1 rest of the world sector. So basically what you have at, you know, in equilibrium, you have the income that equals expenditures. So basically all the income flows are equal to the expenditure flows. And then you also have the quantity supplied is equal to quantity demand in each of the different industry sectors, as well as the quantity supplied of capital, quantity supplied of labor is equal. And then you see prices adjust once you do have a shock in the system. And then you have a 5-year adjustment period. So be clear that when we're presenting these results today, this is something that we're going to see over a lagged period of time. So it's not something that immediately you're going to see all these feedback effects. It's something that will take time, and we assume an adjustment period of 5 years. And just to kind of give you the basic circular flow diagram that kind of represents OTM, you can see this is how kind of it's the structure of the model is we have a goods and services sector, and basically with the goods and services, those are demanded by the households, And the firms are going to supply then the goods and services. And then the households will expend money then on goods and services. Then that provides revenue then back to firms. And then when you conclude the factor market in here, then you can see that the households supply labor to the firms. So they supply one factor of production. And then that is demanded then by the firms. And then the firms will pay back then rents on capital, but they'll also pay labor and wages to households. And then that becomes the household's income. So this is, you know, just trying to help you understand this is an equilibrium. It's a you know, contained unit here and representing Oregon's economy. And when we do, like I was just saying, we do have other more complicated, you know, circular diagram, which is then going to begin to capture the trade and the government sector and things. But, you know, just from a very simplistic point of view, this is really what OTM is trying to do, is capture those feedback effects with the factors of production, adjusting for the different shocks that you're posing in the system. And I guess just to make it clear is that, you know, factor markets are really defining many of the results in this computable general equilibrium model, and it's their ability to react to those different policy changes that is really causing then these changes in income that will flow to the different income groups. Now, if there aren't any questions just about the model itself, I'll go to some of these results. Oh, go ahead.
Thank you. I have a question about the 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
How is that calculated? Is that 5 years into the future or going back 5 years?
Well, Representative Verger, when you're shocking this system, okay, this is based on a particular year, and this, and OTM is right now based on 1997.
Okay,
so we basically captured all the goods and services and the factor markets and everything for 1997 in Oregon.
Okay.
Now, when I go in and I shock this system to look at these different proposals that were, you know, the capital gains cut or the research investment tax credit expansion, all those different things, first I calculate the revenue impact in the current years in which the bill is referring to, then I make adjustments to go back to 97 year dollars.
Okay.
Okay, so that is what I'm using as the basis then for shocking the system. Then when you're bringing it forward, like you're saying, I'm using that percent feedback that I'm seeing in the base year, say 1997. If it was a 21% feedback effect, then I'm saying that for 5 years we'll have a slow feedback that'll be phased in. So if the revenue impact started in 2004, then it would be 1/5 of 21% feedback in the first year of 2004. Then it would be 2/5 in 2005. So you're slowly phasing in. So after 5 years, you will have a feedback effect of 21% if that is, you know, the feedback in the base year.
Mr. Yeah. Chair, if I could add to that, the 5 years is really it's an assumption about how long it takes for the system to adjust back to a new equilibrium. So as Elizabeth pointed out, we're looking at the current system, then we change it, we make a big policy change, and then when everything is adjusted, we're assuming this on average is about a five-year period. And when you think about the adjustments, it's really the keys. This is really a supply-driven model. It's a response of labor, and it's a response of capital. Now, the 5 years, though, I think is best thought of as an average, because to some extent we know that's going to be affected by capacity. If we're in a recession, if there's a lot of excess capacity out there, businesses aren't going to be investing regardless of what the cost of capital is. So that process is likely to be longer. If we're at near full capacity in the economy, businesses are looking to invest. We have a policy changes that makes our capital more attractive, that increases net returns to capital in our state. The response is probably going to be quicker. So the 5 years is really an average, dependent on those external circumstances. But OTM is not a business cycle model. It's not a model that traces recessions and expansions. It is a long-term equilibrium model. We have an economy that's operating in an open system where our capital and labor, we assume, are going to go where the highest returns are. And if we do something policy-wise that increases the returns to those factors, then we'll get more of those in the long run. And that's what OTIM is trying to calculate.
Okay. So, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to thank Paul because I think that it clears it up for me that it's because there is this pent-up demand that you don't see, and then there's this increase in business activity. So, but that's not what this is about anyway.
No. Okay. This is about changing our competitive position in the long term, and the speed at which we adjust is really going to be influenced by a lot of external factors like where we are in the business cycle.
Okay. Oh, well, just one question for the record. Why 1997?
Mr. Chair, 1997 is the base year we used because that's when we had complete data. We used this something called the M-Plan, which has annual data sets. We are now working with Oregon State to update that base year. We have a contract with them, and we hope to have that done and review that with you in the next month or so. But remember, this is a long-run equilibrium model, so it's not the phase we are in the business cycle isn't going to affect these key behavioral factors very much. The main effect it will have, as I say, is on this timing, how long it takes to respond, not the ultimate response.
And when we update, what year will we likely update to as far as 2000?
I think it's 2000 is what the data that they're working on.
I assume this is all limited by...
Yeah, and Chair Shetterly, another component of it was matching property tax property tax accounts with personal income tax accounts, and that's really the final year that we have.
Yeah,
not
the labor-intensive part of this. Well, one other thing, Mr. Chair, I might add on this adjustment period, and it does get it at one of the issues that questions we get often ask is, now, we've gone through, and you'll see in the results that Elizabeth talks about, that we've reduced revenue. I mean, we have a net loss even after feedback. So OTIM assumes we have to balance our budget. So OTIM reduces expenditures by an equal amount to restore balance. And the same thing is true if you increase revenue, then you can increase spending. But and we talk about this 5 years and the adjustment of the labor and capital. What we are much less confident of and do not have really a good handle on in terms of the model are some of the feedbacks you get on the spending side. For example, education. We would assume that if you were to go in and invest X dollars in higher ed, it's probably going to take longer than 5 years to really feel those economic effects. So we're a lot more comfortable on the tax side in terms of behavior than we are on the spending side.
All right.
I think
Representative Scott.
Thank you very much. That was going to be a question that I had. I a couple of your questions that you answered was why 97? And then I'm having difficulty understanding how the business cycle doesn't affect key things as to household supply and revenue.
Representative Scott, it doesn't affect those responses. It affects the overall level of activity, but the key parameters that really drive things are how do you respond to prices? How do you respond to an increase in the price of a product? How do workers respond to a change in wages? How does capital respond to a change in net return? Those are all long-term kind of responses. So what we're saying happens in the business cycle, if we're in recession, particularly in terms of capital, it's going to take longer for that response to occur than it would if we were at full capacity. But the response should be the same in the long run.
But what is the long run?
Well,
if we're going out five, if I may.
Yeah,
if
sure, go
we're
ahead.
Going out 5 years, because that's what I understand, mm-hmm. that we're going out 5 years, assuming that 97 has whatever it has, I mean, obviously that's actual, but if you change some of those percentages by fractions, and your economy either slows or increases, whichever way you want to call it, go, that seems to me that has to have an effect on the percentages that are the outcome effects of that formula.
The, you're talking in terms of the base year influencing what?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, I think that is true. The base year will influence some of those parameters. I mean, if you go through and calculate all of those at the depth of a recession, it would probably affect your calculations. But many of these, the keys to this are a set of what we call elasticities. And the elasticities are not based on running a statistical analysis. They're based on either review of the literature as to how labor responds to a change in wages, or how consumers respond to a change in prices, or many of them are tied, and a real key element in designing this model was the California Dynamic Revenue Analysis Model, the DRAM. And we worked very closely with California, the Department of Finance, and in those areas where we were, in terms of these kind of behavioral responses, we relied a lot on their work. So it's not that we're going through and saying, these are the responses in 1997. We're saying these are the levels in 1997, and these are the responses based on the best information we have.
So then what would be the margin of error?
Well, the margin of error is the margin of error is going to vary with each of those individual assumptions. In our OTIM report, we went through and did a lot of sensitivity analysis where we varied those and we looked at, okay, if this is 0.3 instead of 0.4, what happens? So we did a lot of detailed analysis of that. The area that we identified was most important was what we call trade elasticities, which is how our consumers respond to a change in the price of products sold outside of or produced outside of Oregon, and how people outside of Oregon respond to a change in the price of our products. So, you know, I guess there isn't a simple answer to that. Parameter you're talking about, each of them has some margin of error to it, and if they all are, you know, all too high or all too low, then you could have a substantial margin of error.
And I guess in this case, where we are specifically today comparing bills that are before us, those assumptions are all going to be the same for each of the the analyses. Mm-hmm. The margin of error, I guess, would be comparable. So the concern may not be the actual accuracy, but maybe the comparative value is still going to be have substantial reliability, I would assume.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. Remember what we're doing here in terms of using this for the actual revenue impact analysis. We go through and do our revenue impact analysis the way we normally do, and we tie it to the latest economic and revenue forecast. We then modify it on a percentage basis based on the OTIM results, based on these feedbacks, and those are those percentage feedbacks that Elizabeth talked about. So we have a level that's determined by our normal process, and then it's adjusted by these results.
Okay, anything else?
And just to add on that point, and we do take in the future, say like so many of these proposals are all phased in and things, so we've taken the average then over 5 years as the basis on which then we're shocking the system. So the system doesn't, the shocks that we're using in the system don't just represent 1 year or anything of the impact that we're seeing in the future. It's just brought back to $97 and then averaged for those 5 years.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So just to... make sure I got the right one. Well, that doesn't do hardly anything at all. You can't read that one at all.
Can you look at
that
anyway?
I don't. Oh boy! Now you're really asking.
Otherwise, we'll just forget it. Yeah. Well, we've all got the handout. Here comes Kathy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Our sense of this is much better.
Is that better? A little bit?
Still a little out of focus, but it's bigger.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Are these handouts available to the audience?
Yeah. Okay. Chair Shetterly, this is what you gave. I gave you. This is not the one that was attached originally.
Right.
There was just one
this
little
today.
Change. Correct.
Okay.
So as far as, let me just go through that. We tried to set up kind of a comparison criteria for you to think about with these various proposals. And the first comparison criteria here is positive feedback. And this is, again, what we were talking about, a percentage change. It's not a dollar amount or anything, because, again, that would be represented of the base year. What we're looking at is a percentage change from that occurred in that base year, then we bring that percentage change forward to future years for the feedback effect. So again, the feedback effect is really giving you an understanding of how much in these scenarios of the capital gains cut and the expansion of the research and development credit and the single sales apportionment, those three examples are all reductions in income, which then is going to result in positive feedback effects. Okay, so they always work in the feedback effects work in the opposite direction. So if you have a tax increase, then you're going to have negative feedback effects. If you have a reduction in taxes, that causes a positive feedback effect. So that's what you're seeing here. Now, what I did is try to rank these. So you see there's ranking here, 1, 2, and 3, and then I tried to put in then which proposal there, when you just rank it on the basis of these particular criteria, gives you the best bang for your buck, so
now,
to speak.
I guess, Elizabeth, maybe if I could ask, so the positive feedback then is sort of the gross stimulus effect of each proposal?
Representative Shetterly, that's correct. It's looking at how the producers and consumers in the economy would be responding to those tax cuts.
Okay.
Well, keep in mind, Mr. Chair, that the positive feedback here is a revenue feedback.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
That revenue feedback is determined by our revenue system.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we get something that increases consumption a lot,
right,
we don't see much feedback in,
right,
in the Oregon system. So the net effect, that 21.5% positive feedback, means that the revenue loss would have been 21.5% higher if we hadn't accounted for the economic effects. That's the net effect. The other thing to keep in
mind, say that again.
We're saying that the revenue, if we were to do our standard revenue impact analysis,
oh, I see,
in
right,
the long
right,
run,
right,
it would be 21.5% greater.
Okay.
If we hadn't included that.
Right.
The other thing about the feedback effects is they do include local as well and other fund revenue, so it's not all general fund.
So this, okay, so what you're saying is if you did a static, if you did only a static,
mm-hmm,
analysis, it would reflect a 21.5% greater impact because the positive feedback reduces the static impact of,
correct,
the revenue impact.
In the fifth year.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It would do the same on the revenue gains from a tax increase.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. So that's what you're seeing there, and the 21.5% is the highest feedback effects of any of the three, and that's the R and the D credit. Okay, and again, this is on a percentage basis, so even though you had two proposals dealing with the research and credit, research and development credit, you would still see the same percentage, and this percentage is based on your static estimate in that given year. Okay, so even though your static estimate may be twice the amount, you know, given between those two proposals that you had, you would still see this 21.5% feedback effect because it's a portion of the static shock that you're having.
Well, and that's reflected down below where you've compared the static plus dynamic impact,
correct,
of 2506 and 2950.
That's right. And committee members, right down here is where under tax year 1997, I've given you the static revenue impact for each one of those. And then you can see like the 21% there for the capital gains. Oh, that wasn't, that's not, capital gains cut is not 21%, but capital gains cut is up here at 6.9%. Now that is the lowest as far as feedback effects of the three, as far as, you know, and the reason why, I mean, if you think about it, capital gains cut is primarily on households, okay? So you're not going to see then the stimulative effect in the different factor markets and stuff for this, you know, reduction in taxes that you're giving. Okay, households are going to have additional income, but they're also going to choose between savings and then purchasing new goods. Okay, and the purchasing of new goods creates a stimulus effect in the economy, but it doesn't. It's not a direct one-for-one. And so that's why these other scenarios where you've got research and development credit, that is really stimulating the factor markets. It's making research and development across the board is making the taxes for those particular industries, you know, cheaper. It's making capital cheaper for them. So they can invest more, which then can lead then to more purchases of capital. And that's what these are designed to do. And same thing with the single sales tax.
Almost had something there.
Yeah, just on the idea of the spending and the stimulus, keep in mind that, again, OTEM is a balanced budget model. So you really don't, if you increase consumer spending, you're also going to be reducing government spending because you have less revenue to spend at the government level. So what tends to, because OTIM is a long-term model, what really affects it is these returns to factors, something that increases returns to capital, increases returns to labor, changes our long-term competitive position. We can't stimulate OTIM by doing traditional pump priming where we would give consumers a tax cut and have them spend more money, because what happens if they spend more money, we just have less government money to spend. So unless we can run deficits, which of course we can't, then that's not going to have very much of a stimulative effect. What has a stimulative effect is the supply side. We get more capital in Oregon, we get more labor in Oregon, we get more productivity from our workers. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that cause the feedbacks.
Representative Berger?
I have a question about that then, Paul. Taking what you've just said over to the R&D credit, that 21.5% doesn't really make the assumption that the R&D credit was successful?
Representative Virgil, what that shows is that as a result of the R&D credit, we now have the net after-tax return to capital is now higher in Oregon than it was before the tax change. So you end up with more capital in Oregon as a result of that than you would have had otherwise. So with more capital and any of these other indexes down here that Elizabeth will go through, we have a capital index that increases, shows we have higher return to capital. Wages go up because workers with more capital are more productive. So that pushes up their wage. So those are the positive feedbacks that are captured in OTIM.
Okay. Go ahead.
So the next criteria here to look at is just personal income. And this is a ratio here just to give you, because you've got real differences in the net revenue impact with these different scenarios. So what this is looking at personal income, the change in personal income over the net revenue impact. So what this is a ratio basically. And the net revenue impact in personal income is in terms of millions of dollars. Okay, so what this is saying to you is for every reduction of $1 million in revenue impact, you would get $1.98 million in personal income with the R&D credit. That produces, again, the largest stimulus effect in the economy of all these three scenarios is $1.98 million in additional personal income. And you can see here on single sales, it's 1.18, and then capital gains is the smallest amount at $650,000.
Thanks. Did you say one for every $1 million spent on R&D credit, the result is 1.98?
Yeah, 1.98 million in personal income.
So for every $1 million less in revenue, the state would take in as a result of this tax credit. 1.98 represents what?
It's personal income, additional personal income that is created in the economy.
This is a long-run equilibrium. So what we're saying is, okay, when we fully adjusted, we're saying that for every $1 million reduction in revenue, and that when we fully adjusted, income is 1.98 million higher. So that's really overall economic activity.
Personal income, not revenue to the state.
Right, and so personal income is our measure of overall economic activity.
Okay. And I guess in the case of R&D, for instance, what drives that? What is the connection between the million spent and the 1.98 million in additional revenue? Where's that coming from?
Well, I'd just like to comment one point with R&D versus single sales and stuff in that area is the R&D is a very broad credit. So that and what we're doing in that those proposals is even making it broader as far as the industries that can take that. So what it is you know, causing those firms to invest more in their capital. And with that, so in R&D, this really isn't a, you know, having to choose and things between different industries. It's pretty broad, and a lot of different industries will take advantage of it. Now, with the single sales apportionment, that's different. There are winners, and there are clearly losers from a change to a 100% sales apportionment formula. So that is one where, you know, you aren't seeing quite the increase in personal income because there are some industries that won't be benefited from that proposal. So you've got a netting going on there with that, and that's why single sales does not do as well in the personal income or the gross change in investment.
But back to your question, Mr. Chair, on the what happens with R&D credit, you see on the next line is you have this change in investment. And this is investment in physical capital. So the change in investment is equal to the change in the capital stock. So you get more capital out there. With that greater capital in Oregon as a result of that, households get more income directly from that capital, owners of capital, plus the workers get more because the wage index, as you can see, is being pushed up through higher productivity. It makes the system more capital intensive. It's what we call capital deepening, where you've got a more capital-intensive industry because the returns to capital are higher as a result of this policy.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Berger.
Stop just a minute and go back to the time, the five-year for me, because I missed something here. Numbers are static. Time is not. How do these numbers relate to the 5 years? Are these things at the end of 5 years or at the end of 5 years in your model, but it may be longer or shorter depending on economic factors? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. The 21.5% feedback on the R&D credit is after 5 years.
Assuming that your model is correct and 5 years is the actual...
5 years is an average time period.
Exactly.
So what
okay.
we're saying is if the economy is real slow here, let's say we have an extended period of whether it's just not enough capacity or there's too much capacity in the system, investment is very slow, it would take longer than
that. It would take longer. Okay, I just wanted to get the time.
There are kind of two assumptions, I think, that are built into this. One, the, for instance, looking at the positive feedback on R&D, 21.5, that is the new equilibrium number. I mean, that's the number when the economy is restored at equilibrium.
Yes.
And the other assumption is that equilibrium, the period of that restoration to equilibrium is 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if it takes 7 years on average, if it's 7 years, you're saying that you would still end up at you know, roughly the same number. The period to restore equilibrium would be longer, but the net effect would still be the same.
Right. So what we're doing in terms of our policy in Oregon is we're not affecting the big pie, you know, the total amount of capital,
right.
total amount of labor. All of that, all of those are external to us. We're just affecting our share.
Right.
So we're saying we would get a higher share as a result of this policy, everything else the same.
Okay.
Carry on.
Okay. And so, Mr. Chairman, with the change then in investment again over the net revenue impact, it has the same results as the personal income over net revenue impact. Like Paul is saying, this really is what's driving your increase in personal income is your change in investment there. And so, again, R&D is ranked number one, and the highest in single sales is second, and capital gains is third. Now, the net job changes is the next interesting one. Now, the net job change is, again, just the number of jobs divided by the net revenue impact. So what this 32 is telling you is that for every 1 million in reduction in net revenue from a shock, then you're going to get 32 additional people hired in the economy. So this is from in the number one policy that would give you the most in employment is the capital gains tax cut. And the reason why this is because we have full equilibrium in the economy, and we basically have to see adjustments then. And what we see is a net in-migration of workers because of this capital gains cut. And those are some of the assumptions that are made in this model as far as having full equilibrium. And again, as we were saying, when you've got a cut in capital gains, you've got obviously more money from the capital gains cut for different households, but you've also got a reduction then in spending at the government level from that capital gains cut. So with this particular scenario, this net job change of 32 workers for every 1 million reduction in revenue is such that it really is a result of some of the assumptions that are made in the model as far as net migration coming in. And then that flows through to why we have then an increase then in wages.
Let me ask... So you're saying that the OTIM says the capital gains tax cut would generate more new employment than either of the other two, and yet would generate less, substantially less, in additional personal income.
Right.
Explain that.
Well, Chairman Shetterly, it's because of these assumptions that are inherent in the model as far as full employment. And once you have a capital gains cut such that you're going to stimulate, we've got a migration, in-migration and out-migration in the model. And those are a function of your tax system. And so when you're having a reduction then in household taxes, that's going to stimulate the population to come to Oregon. I mean, that's one component of it. Now, the reason why you're not getting the positive feedback is, again, because what this is doing is you've got a reduction in household income, but you also have a reduction then in government spending. And the two of them then are not stimulating any of these factors of production. And you may be getting some when you see households then it will portion of their, tax cut will be saved, but then a portion will be, buying new, cars and things like that. And so, you will see a stimulus effect in the economy, but it's not going to be to the same effect as you would get if you had an R&D credit or a single sales factor where you're clearly changing the factors of production. You're clearly changing those costs. Those prices of capital are changing. So that is a direct then benefit to encourage then the firms to want to stimulate the economy and buy more capital.
So back to that, Mr. Chair, I think this really gets it seems counterintuitive on the jobs versus income to have two different results, but it really gets at the heart of what OTIM is. OTIM is a long-term model. It's looking at our long-term competitive position. It's not dealing with the business cycle and what phase we are in the business cycle. So how do you get net job growth? Well, you get net job growth through getting more labor in the state, and that's how OTIM works. So each of those factors of production has an elasticity or a mobility. What the R&D credit does is it pulls in new capital
right. And
gives the existing workers more to work with. What capital gains does is it increases the net income of particularly high-income households, and you can see this down below on the distribution. And OTIM assumes that group has a higher mobility, that they respond more than lower income people do to a higher net income. So it has a mobility parameter for those different income groups. And that's where you get, so as a result of the capital gains, you end up with an increase, in effect, an increase in the labor supply, or a reduction in out-migration, another way of looking at it.
Okay. All right.
Okay, so basically with the results then, you've got the capital gains producing the largest bang for your buck in terms of net jobs. And then R&D is second with basically 13 jobs, roughly 14 jobs per every 1 million reduction in net revenue. And then with single sales, you've got 3 new jobs for every 1 million reduction. Now, I want to just highlight and make sure everyone's clear why single sales is quite a bit lower than R&D credit. And again, the reason why is because with single sales, what you're doing is you are giving a when you're moving to 100% sales, that benefits the manufacturers in the state, those with a lot of property, those with a lot of payroll, but it is not helping those labor-intensive industries like retail. And those are the ones that then are going to be seeing reductions in the economy from this single sales. So that's why then you'll see overall that the change in employment is not much. And then with your capital index and your wage index, this is basically just a composite of all of the different industries, return to capital and return to wages. And this is such that it's, you know, really explained a lot of things we've been talking about already, where R&D gives you your biggest percentage increase there in your return to capital. And single sales is not far behind. And then the change in capital, capital gains tax cut creates no incentive whatsoever, gives no additional return to capital. And that's, as we were talking about, why you don't see much of a stimulus backed up here for the positive feedback effects. And then with the wage index, again, the R&D creates a bit more of a positive return to wages. And single sales is slightly below that. And then capital gains is causing a reduction then in wages because you're getting a net migration of individuals to the state. Well, then that's increasing your labor supply.
Stated in a lot more colloquial terms, do I understand this right? And this goes back to the comparison between net job and personal income impact as well. Is that because R&D and single sales tend to focus on industries that have higher paying jobs, and where we would see the growth in wages or the growth in employment with the capital gains stimulus? It's interesting comparing that against you're looking at a reduction in the wage index. Is that because that would affect the broader spectrum and lower paying?
Well, what happens with the capital gains is that you have more people in the state.
Right.
You increase the supply of labor. So that ends up reducing that net wage, but see the reduction in wage is offset by the increased number of jobs and the increase and that shows up in the higher income level. But what this sales factor does is, and recall the charts we had, and we've looked at this in particular last session, is that there are actually a higher number of firms that have a tax increase from the sales apportionment factor. Now, their revenue impact is less because we have the higher taxpayers are in the ones that benefit. But many of those industries that have a relatively small loss spread across them are labor intensive. You know, there are things that are not going to be as capital intensive. So what both the R&D credit and the apportionment formula do is particularly benefit the manufacturing sector. And that's where the higher-paying jobs are.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Berger?
Thank you. Elizabeth, go back and say it one more time so I'm really clear. On the personal income net revenue impact ratio, R&D, the 1 million to 1.98. Mm-hmm. Go through the 1 million for every reduction. Keep going.
Okay. basically, for every 1 million of net revenue loss, there would be then 1.98 million increase in personal income. And again, that's you're comparing
revenue.
Income versus net revenue loss, so it's not, you know, like saying it's a one for one. I mean, remember, your personal income would not, it's going to eventually translate into new tax.
Right, exactly.
But not one for one. I mean, right?
Net revenue loss to the state
and local, or to the
taxing district in a static sense. Is that okay?
Yeah.
But Representative Berger, if you think about that positive feedback, you know, who's going to benefit, particularly something that's capital intensive like an R&D credit or like the single sales, you're going to get a net increase in property taxes. Because you're going to be, you know, those are going to go on the roll. So that's part of that positive feedback.
I understand it isn't then 1.9 back to the taxing district, but I'm just wondering exactly what that $1 million represents.
The other point about the capital gains is it has a ratio of 0.65. That still means that income is higher, even though you have less revenue. Income in the economy is higher.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
How are we doing? Okay.
Okay.
So let's leave these comparison criteria. Now, again, I think this you know, table here should clearly illustrate to you what, you know, most states have had up until OTM has really been just this top table right here. You know, computable gender equilibrium models have usually just dealt with feedback effects. But what OTM added, which is, you know, something that is cutting edge, is add then a tax incident model to it on top of that, by really giving you a good breakdown then of households and the impact that the households are going to feel from these different tax changes. And what is very important with this is if we do look at any tax reform proposals, this can then, you know, add various tax reform proposals together and then show you overall what the tax burden would be after you have these various tax reforms. So that is clearly one of the big assets of OTM, is it's the only place that we have where we've got all our taxes in one distribution here.
So you're showing these each as analyzed individually.
Correct.
And you can blend these.
But you can blend them, yeah. Mr. Mm-hmm. Chairman, and that's something that, you know, I haven't done with this example, but just recognize that's an asset of it, you know, of this model.
Well, Mr. Gregg, if you're thinking about a major tax restructure proposal that adds revenue and subtracts revenue over here, then we can net that out.
Right.
Okay, so again, our tax year 1997, this just gives you an understanding of what I used to shock these various scenarios. So you've got the static revenue impact then in millions, and this is a reduction here for capital gains of $75 million, and then for our capital gains tax cut proposal, then a minus $7.6 million in the single sales factor. And then with research and development credit, then you've got the two different proposals, House Bill 2506, which was the larger change in that credit, and that was a reduction of $47.6 million, and then 2950, which was a reduction of roughly $25 million. And again, I took the average when these particular proposals were going to be in place, when they were going to be phased in, took the five-year average, and then rolled that back to $97. Okay, so, and then you see that the static plus dynamic revenue impact. So, you know, in the capital gain scenario, this is just a feedback effect of 6.9%, and that comes out to, you know, roughly $70 million. So that just at least gives you an understanding of what we're doing in the after 5 years when this would be fully phased in. Now, just with these different income groups, again, you've got nine different income groups, and this baseline here just gives you a share of the total tax liability there. So that's what the baseline is, just a share of your total tax liability for these different income groups. So you can see initially the lower income groups, you know, less than 14,000 only pay 2.8% of the tax, and that goes up slightly between 14,525 and 21,225 to 4.5. So it's going up slightly until you hit 62,026 to 80,000, and then that slightly is reduced to 14.5% of the total tax. But obviously the largest portion is right down here then in the 80,000 to 126,173 category, where you've got 21% of all of the taxes is bored by that income group.
You know, those ranges, taxable income?
That is actually personal income.
Household
income. Okay. Yeah, and that's larger. Yeah, and it includes capital gains. So now we're going to be looking here at what are the share then of these different income groups from these different proposals. And really the sharp difference here is with the capital gains cut proposal, you can see that, you know, 55% of that capital gains cut proposal will be given to the above 126,173 households. And those households that are in that income group. And very little of it in the lower income groups, you know, only 1 to 3% up to $28,739. Okay, so then when we look at the single sales apportionment and the research and development credit, they really aren't much different. You can see there that the breakdown is almost exactly the same. Very little in the lower income groups, but then it rises quite quickly when you're hitting the 28,739 group on up. And so it's pretty proportional that the single sales apportionment has, you know, a slightly higher percent for those above 126,173, 23% versus 22%.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Farr.
So, Elizabeth, you're saying that in my income group, I would only get a 2% increase in capital gains?
There you go.
So, you know, if they're, you know, this is pretty straightforward as far as understanding just the, you know, who's going to be benefiting from these various proposals. And, you know, clearly with the capital gains cut, you are benefiting the higher income categories versus, you know, with these other ones, which are really kind of changing the corporate credits and their apportionment, then you're going to see the shareholders are usually in the higher income groups, and that's why you're seeing then more of that, you know, tax benefit being extended to the higher income groups.
I'm just curious, what accounts for that jump under the capital gains? That 14. Jump from 3% in the one group to 14%, and then back down to 8 and 7. What accounts for that jump there? What's happening in that?
Chairman Shetterly, I'm not exactly sure, but I would imagine there's some, you know, seniors in this category, and, you know, maybe that would be, okay. You know. Yeah.
All right. Other questions for Elizabeth? We've got some other folks to testify today, but I want to give us time to digest. Well, I shouldn't say two, at least two on this.
Go ahead. I guess the ultimate question for us is what we're buying here, and you mentioned, you know, what's the best bang for your buck. And I guess I would just be interested in your appraisal or Paul's opinion of these, which would do the most to stimulate the economy based on these results in the short term and long term.
I'll address that, Mr. Chair. The you know, what OTIM does is it gives you the results based on, you know, based on the best of economic theory. I mean, it's a model that is consistent and logically tracks through these responses. So I guess the simple answer to this, it depends on, you know, what it is you're trying to achieve. And if you're trying to increase personal income in the system, the overall level of activity, and comparing that with the lost revenue, then the biggest feedback and benefit would come from the R&D credit. If your objective is to increase long-run employment in the system relative to your net revenue loss, then the biggest feedback would be on the capital gains side. So it doesn't give you a clear answer as to what is what. It just tells you under different criteria what policy objective you decide to go for, which would get you there on a dollar per dollar revenue loss basis. So it does give you some objective criteria, but kind of your role here as policymakers is think what is it that we want to maximize? What is our target?
A very clear choice, I would say. Representative.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that I understand the percentages here. Looking under capital gains, the income group beginning at 28,739, they get, that entire group would get 14% of the 75 million.
Representative Farr, that's how much feedback effect they're getting. Not the 75 million is my static shock. Mm-hmm. Of the system, you know, we're talking here about the feedback, the positive mm-hmm. feedback. So they will get, you know, in the capital gains cut, what the total feedback is roughly, you know, 5 million.
Yeah. Okay.
So of the 5 million, they would be getting 14%.
Well, Representative Farr, what they get on the is the what this the household incomes. It looks at your income before the shock and your income afterwards. Mm-hmm. So there's an increase in income, and it's that top line, you know, the 1.98 times the revenue loss for the case of R&D credit. It says, okay, income is now higher. How is it distributed compared to before the shock?
Okay.
And so if you look at something like, you know, the less than 14,000, they have 2.8% of income before the shock. They got 1% of the gain.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that explains it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Elizabeth.
I was just going to say, Representative Shetterly, do you want me to explain at all any of the other new revenue impacts that you have for the different bills?
Oh, for the bills, sure. Let's hear those, and we'll bring them.
Briefly run you through that.
Please.
Okay, so to begin with, I pretty much took each one of these bills again and then just reworked the revenue impact. And in the research and development credits, the first time I ran them, I didn't have any feedback effects. So with House Bill 2950, and this...
Just a second.
I'm sorry. 2950. Was another order you wanted to go in?
You can tell us and we'll find our file.
Okay, so 2950 is what I was looking at.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is the one that's eliminating the limitations on the fields of qualified and basic research under current law, and it's increasing that maximum amount of the credit per business, but it's only going up to $2 million, but the other proposal goes up to $5 million. So basically on this one, again, the R&D credit had, you know, over 5 years, you would have a 21.5% positive feedback effect. So this has this feedback effect phased in then. And so you can see that the total, the last column there, which actually I throw this up here.
Let's get on the same page.
Okay. So the last column here is what we're looking at now, where basically with the positive feedback effects, you would have $15.2 million as total static and dynamic in the 2003-2005 biennium, and then you would have $42 million in the 2005-2007 biennium. And then out by the 2007-2009 biennium, that's when you would have the full phase-in of the 21% feedback effect to have 68.1%. And this is one that also it has the sunset provision in here, and that's why it's increasing so quickly out here in 08 and 09 is because you have an extension of the – it's eliminating that sunset date.
Okay.
So questions on this?
This is R&D.
Okay. Now I'll go to the other research and development credit proposal, the 2506. Now, with House Bill 2506, this one was slightly increased the percentage also, in addition to increasing that maximum amount and eliminating the sunset. It increases the percentage of eligible expenses for the research and development credit from 5% to 20%, and then again eliminating the limitations on the fields of qualified and basic research. It increases that maximum amount of the credit from $500,000 to $1 million in 2004, and then it goes up to $5 million then beginning in 2005. And then, again, it's got the sunset that's eliminated in that proposal. So, again, you've got a final column over here, which then includes your dynamic effect, and that is roughly $31 million in the 2003-2005 biennium reduction. And then you've got $91.2 million in the 2005-2007 biennium and $120 million in the 2007-2009 biennium. And previously, I'd forgotten to put in the sunset in 2008 and 2009, so that's why this is slightly higher than what it was originally in the first estimate.
All right.
Okay.
Do you want to ask Representative Hash, were you working on amendments to one of these?
Yes.
Okay. You haven't had Elizabeth run those yet, though?
No.
Okay.
Okay, so if we want to look at House Bill 3183, that's the apportionment formula changes. And this one, the only change I made was just because of our discussion that we had last week about the timing of this. And this was, it should have been beginning in fiscal year 05-06. So that's basically what I've done here is just put in 05-06. But I've also then, the feedback effects are not as large as they were initially just because I have started them 1 year later. And so basically with the feedback effects in 2005-06, you're looking at $5.8 million and $5.9 million in 2006-07, which is a total then of $11.7 million for the 2005-07 biennium and $22.5 million in the 2007-09 biennium. And again, with this, you know, revenue impact, this is one that, you know, it will be good to consider some 2001 corp data, and I think Department of Revenue may be able to provide me with some preliminary numbers and just to check some of those assumptions that I made, since this is so heavily dependent on the corporate apportionment and the amount of revenue and income that is generated from those corporations that just apportion their income each year. So, you know, this is one of those that, you know, as we go through the session, we'll be looking at some of these numbers and making sure we're good ballpark assumptions we've made.
Okay.
And then finally, the last bill was your 2505, which is reduction in the capital gains. And then on this one, basically, again, it reduces the top income tax rate on capital gains, and it phases that in beginning in 2004 at 8.5%. Then it's going down one percentage point until 2008 when it hits 5%. And then the corporate income tax on capital gains is also reduced to 5% beginning in 2008. So then the revenue impact here, and these numbers have slightly changed from the last time I did this because I did run it in more detail in our tax calculator for the static revenue estimates. And then with the feedback effects, these are looking at 6.9% as the total feedback effects after it's been phased in. And this includes both the portfolio effect as well as the dynamic effect. And with capital gains, what you're going to be getting then is an increase in the additional tax because we'll have more people that would want to realize their capital gains when they have a lower tax rate. So this is getting at some of the, you know, trying to break out that feedback effect to not only be a stimulus in the economy, but also increase in tax just due to those increased realizations. So that's what you're getting with the portfolio effect. So the capital gains is just one of those unique ones that, you know, really is kind of changing people's behavior about how often they would want to realize their gains from capital. Now, with this, what you're seeing is it's roughly $15.9 million in the 03-05 biennium. In the 05-07 biennium, $135 million, and then in the 07-09 biennium, $291.2 million with the feedback effects. Are there any other questions on this?
Other questions? All right, thank you very much. Lots of information.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Thompson.
Mr. Chair, I just have one question. The class for remedial learners is scheduled when?
Well, we'll have night school at night class will be 7:30. Just get to hear the same thing over again. Repetition being
I hope.
Yeah, that's right. We've got a couple of folks signed up to testify here, so I want to bring them forward. First, on House Bill 3183, Kirk Copenhagen. Oh. 3183 again being the single sales. Mr. Copenhagen.
Yes, Chairman Shetterly, committee members. Some of you probably remembered I was here in 2001 whining about the impact to Longview Fiber Company, so I came back to give it another shot. This, when fully implemented, will cost our company about $500,000 a year. In over 10 years, it projects out to about $5 million. We've been around the state for about 40 years. Most of our timberlands were acquired in, 3 and 4 decades ago. We have indirect employment of 65, 70 independent logging contractors, forestry contractors. And they've been with us for full-time virtually for many, many years. So they're like employees. But we do have a small direct employment. So anyway, we also do some providing of logs. About 70% of our logs in the state go to local sawmills. We in turn like to buy chips back for paper making up at our Longview paper mill. We provide logs for decades to Oregon sawmills. And we put about, up to $50 million annually into the state economy by buying chips. These chips, again, come, or many of them, from logs that we sell to the mills. And finally, some of our other contributions to the state include protecting the public benefits in salmon recovery and fish stream restoration. Some of the things that we've done there is that we have our corporate biologists and foresters and large investments in assisting the state salmon plan and many of the projects on our own land. So long story short, we feel that we've done a lot for the state. We've been around. We happen to have our headquarters across the river in Longview. This would affect us unfairly. And we certainly have nothing against the companies that are seeking this tax savings. As I recall, however, in 2001, about twice as many losers develop out of this, losing companies, as winners. And over half the benefits go to 20 to 30 companies out of those winners. So we're saying this is not fair to some companies. And I guess hat in hand, we ask that some consideration be given to some kind of tax relief for a company like ours, which is caught in between. And I'm open to any questions.
All right. Questions from Copenhagen.
I didn't catch the name of your company.
I'm sorry. I'm Public Affairs Director for Longview Fiber Company.
Longview Fiber.
Okay. We're one of the largest timberland owners in the state. We have about a third of a million acres in six tree farms in western Oregon and in the Columbia Gorge. And most of our manufacturing there is in Longview.
All right. Further questions for Mr. Copenhagen? All right. Thanks for coming forward. You bet. Anybody else on 3183? Okay, Joe Schweiner, to have you up on 2505. And that's the only other witness I have signed up, so if anybody else wants to testify, be ready to raise your hand here when Joe is done.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweiner, Associate Oregon Industries, and for the record, we have 22,000 plus businesses, 98% of which are small business. I feel like I've been shocked and awed by the O-Town model, as you have. We have some questions. I've got some comments on capital gains I'd like to bring forward, but first I'd like to get back into the OTEM model. It's my understanding that the OTEM model, in what you've heard today, is the OTEM model looks at the average. It looks at the average over 5 years, and that it does not look at the business cycle. And being an average model, it starts at a base and goes at an angle up to that 5 years. Our economy is not doing that. Our economy is going sideways. 5 years from now, it may be close to that number they have. But where are our numbers on capital gains for the next few years? Are we going to realize that much in capital gains? How much do we have in capital? How much is it going to cost the state? And how much do we have now that we're saying we're going to lose? If you don't have it, you can't lose it. And I think it's... like I said, it's been shocking all over the OTEM model, but I think there needs to be some look at what capital gains effect is now versus what it could have in the future.
Well, John, looking at the fiscal the revenue impact that Elizabeth gave us, and actually shows that for 03-04, for instance, $1.2 million. So I think that assumes a fairly low impact in terms of real dollars. That reflects, I think, where we are in the capital market.
Representative Shetterly, that's correct. I mean, I think what probably Joe is referring to is underlying assumptions, right, of just capital gains is coming from OEA. And so, you know, we use the forecast that DAS puts out as far as, in addition to the forecast in your big booklet, but they also give us capital gains assumptions. So I think that's what, you know, it's not OTM, it's the assumptions that go into the static revenue.
Well, they go into the model,
that,
yes.
You know, is what you're questioning. So, you know, we can discuss that. I can make a copy of the capital gains income flows that we are assuming when we begin the static estimate.
Oh, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I might, but those arguments are made, again, on that average assumption that there's a line being used to go to that five-year outcome versus a static that we may not see those capital gains doing anything. We don't see them going up. We don't see the economy moving too much. And that could have an effect on what your numbers are for that capital gains in the next at least 18 months, 24 months, this coming biennium. And I guess what I'm saying is the lower that goes, the less you have, the less impact it's going to make in the future. Now, if we pass a capital gains reduction, we are not going to see those big numbers on the revenue impacts because they're just not there. But what you would be doing, and the comment, the point was made in 2001, they figured that in, I think it was Senate Bill 67, they found that a 5% capital gains cut in the 2001 session would have increased employment in Oregon's economy by 4,500 jobs. Now, if we assume that capital gains isn't there right now, but there obviously, hopefully, the economy will start to grow, we would put our economy in a much better situation if those capital gains were lower to provide a higher number of jobs. We also talked about stimulating this jobs. We have a 7.3%, one of the highest unemployments in the nation, yet we're talking about in this model of importing immigration of workers. I'm not sure how that calculation plays in the total of the effect on the capital gains. I guess the point I'm trying to make is if it's a long-term model, we've got short-term problems. And I think we need to look at some type of study or numbers over the last few years to get a more accurate idea of where the capital gains is going to affect our revenue stream. And then look at long-term, the economy starts to come back, as it did, as the numbers that we saw in the year 2001, and say, wow, this could have a great impact on jobs. And we're talking a jobless recovery. The more impact we can have on forming those jobs, the better we would be. And I guess that's where I'm coming from on my statement. I wrote down a few other things here. Even though capital gains is very low right now, it still makes a tremendous impact on jobs, even in the model. And what does it take into effect on the consumer? The comment was made that it goes to individuals that will be making the most out of capital gains. Well, guess what? The consumer is the person that spends the money that drives the economy. So the more money we can put into their hands, the better.
Okay.
And if I would, I would like to end up and finish my comments what I originally was going to make the statement. I've got some studies here I'm going to hand out as I leave for you to look at, but all analysis of capital gains tax acknowledges that it plays a major role in capital formation. Capital formation leads to higher productivity, higher demand for labor. Venture capital is vital to our economy. Capital gains will add to that. It will greatly be increased by cutting capital gains. Cuts in capital gains will encourage investment by increasing the return on that investment. By cutting capital gains, you are making an investment in that future. Other states are moving forward. Washington's unemployment has dropped. Unemployment in the U.S. is 5.8%. Oregon's unemployment is 7.3%. Two further points to consider. One is capital gains is also our most volatile and hardest revenue to forecast. The capital gains, number two is capital gains reduction is the number one issue for this legislative session to our membership. 22,000 plus businesses are saying that this tax is harmful. It's a disincentive for business growth. Who better to understand those effects? We need to listen to the experts. Taxes are the greatest detriment to this economic recovery, and your constituents need your help. One other point to be made. Your colleagues in the Bipartisan Growth Caucus, about 38 members, have found that the reduction in capital gains is part of their plan. This is a very important issue for business and for the economy. And you need to seriously consider looking at these numbers on capital gains short-term as well as the long-term effect it'll have once the economy starts to grow. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify on any of the bills that are before us today? We are still in public hearing on 2505, 3183, 2506, and 2950. Going once, going twice. close the public hearing on those bills and with that committee. Thank you for your time and attention for this engaging morning. We are adjourned.
If you make a run.